Hi, this is Faith Mitchell, President of Grantmakers in Health. I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition in GIH's podcast series. Our goal is to provide you with an insider's view of what's happening on the front lines of health by hearing from leaders in the field. I hope you enjoy these podcasts and find them insightful as you lead your philanthropic work.
I'm delighted to be here to introduce you to Judy Belk of the California Wellness Foundation. As President and CEO, Judy leads the California Wellness Foundation in pursuing its mission to improve the health of the people of California. She uses her vision and her voice to help the foundation level the playing field so that everyone has access to good-paying jobs, safe neighborhoods, and quality health services. Judy is a seasoned leader with more than 25 years of senior management experience in the philanthropic, government, nonprofit, and corporate sectors. Before joining the foundation, Judy served as a senior vice president of Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors, helping to position RPA as a global thought leader in promoting effective strategic philanthropy, impact investment, and diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. Previously, Judy served as vice president of global public affairs at Levi Strauss & Company, with responsibilities for both the company's and the foundation's leadership in the global fight against AIDS, as well as their economic development, environmental, and anti-racism initiatives. She also developed and led the company's philanthropic efforts in post-apartheid South Africa. Judy is a frequent writer and speaker on organizational ethics, race, and social change, and her work has been recognized with several state and national awards. Her pieces have aired on National Public Radio, which I listen to several hours a day, and appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. Throughout her career, Judy has been a strong advocate in promoting diversity, inclusion, and equity, both within and outside the philanthropic sector. She's been a passionate voice in raising awareness of the needs of women and girls, of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities, and of people of color. We've invited Judy to visit with you this evening because she is smart, she's powerful, and persuasive, and we are eager to hear what's on her mind. Having read some of Judy's writings, my favorite of which is titled, Impatience Can Be a Virtue to Rethinking the How of Philanthropy. I encourage you to check out that blog post. I expect she will challenge us, inspire us, and kick off a thoughtful, candid series of discussions about philanthropy's roles and role in these complex times. Please join me in welcoming Judy Belk.
Music. All right, Faith, great music selection. Well, thank you, Brenda, for that lovely introduction. I listened to that and I just feel old. That's what I feel. Well, I want to thank Faith and I want to thank the board of Grantmakers in Health for this generous invitation to help kick off this year's conference. I'm really feeling Boston. I went and took a walk to the river. You guys really should do that. I didn't get lost. There's a big sign that says Sheraton on this building, so you could find it. Kind of ran into a monument on women, historical women leaders in Boston, Phyllis Wheatley. So I would encourage you to take advantage of just walking through the neighborhoods and to the river. Boy, you know, we were in San Diego last year, and so much has changed. I don't know about each of you, but this degree of uncertainty, anxiety in the world, the country, and in the healthcare sector, I mean, some mornings I just feel like not getting out of bed, just pulling the covers up. That's why I'm hoping we'll take a deep breath, take a break while we're here, from CNN, MSNBC, Fox, presidential tweets, wherever you get your news, just kind of take a chill. So you heard and you've seen with the apps and everything, there is so much for us to sample while we're here. So of course, as I read all of the materials and everything that was going to be on the agenda, I thought to myself, okay, what can I bring to the conversation? So, I've decided to go personal. I'm going to focus on three themes that keep popping up for me as I think about how I and maybe you can do your best work during this time of change. So the first is courage. What does it mean to have courage in philanthropy? And how can we find the courage to stand up for what we believe? So that's one. The other thing is justice. I've been thinking a lot about justice and the role of foundations in building a fairer, more just society. And last but not least, I've been thinking about moi, me, myself. I mean, I find myself yelling at the TV, you know, going nuts at what I read. You know, Judy, okay, that's fine, but what about you? What can you do to enhance the world around you? So courage, justice, and self, those are three big, scary concepts. I'm going to dig into each one. I'm a storyteller. If you read what I write, I talk and think in stories. And of course, since I live in Hollywood, I really do live in Hollywood, I'm going to share a little video starring one of my favorite voices in California, Kelly. So you'll get to meet that. So, first, courage. The ability to do something that frightens one. Now, this is a definition that really hits home for me, because at my core, I am really a scaredy cat. I am not one of those folks who runs quickly to danger, and I have an abundance of courage in reserve. I usually get courageous by being shamed into it, or by surrounding myself with folks who help me to be courageous. So, for example, I have a group of mostly women friends who are strategically placed in time zones around the world. So someone's awake at any given time. Really try it. And usually the call goes something like this, like, you know, I'm really worried about this. And they're saying, Judy, do you know what time it is? And then I say, well, you know, I don't know if they should do this. And they usually say, you know what you have to do, Belk. Just do it. So here's one story of courage that has stayed with me for years. And so whenever I feel these cowardly demons surfacing, it serves to give me a really swift kick in the butt. Early in my philanthropic career, you heard, for 10 years, I ran the Levi Strauss Foundation, which had a global focus on women's economic development. As I was wrapping up my last year at the foundation, I decided to treat myself to a farewell tour of sorts, visiting some of my favorite programs around the globe that were funded during my tenure. I saved the best for last. It was a woman's microloan program in a rural village outside of Manila in the Philippines. The director of the NGO, she gathered some of the women entrepreneurs so they could personally share their stories. There was a language barrier, but the NGO director translated. As the women spoke, I was feeling really good. You know, that kind of grant maker kind of glow, like you did something other than just give money to a good organization. I was thinking, this was a damn good grant, strategic, impactful. So I was feeling really good. So at the end of the visit, one of the women in the group approached the director and whispered a question. I figured I already knew what the questions would be. Having done a fair enough site visits and travel throughout rural Asia, there are a couple of questions that usually pop up. It usually has to do with my height and that I'm black. But this time I was wrong. The director turned to me and said, she wants to know if you have any children. Well, I'll talk to anyone about my children. And I was feeling, okay, we're going to have a connection here. So I says, yes, I have two young children. And through the director, I asked, how many children do you have? She giggled and she raised five fingers. She didn't seem much older than 18 or 19. I made a gesture to communicate how tired she must be. She nodded her head in agreement and then whispered again to the director. She wants to know who is taking care of your children while you're here. I said, my husband. Now the woman had a look of concern, and it was a lot of whispering going back and forth. The director was getting embarrassed. Something was up. So then she reluctantly leaned over and whispered to me, and this is what she said. She wants to know if your husband will beat you when you return home. I still get a deep, like, punch in the stomach when I share that story. So I looked at the woman, and the expression on her face, it showed a hint of worry, but it was like a matter-of-fact kind of worry, as if she was telling me or asking me if I was too hot standing in the sun, as if it was normal. Well, I started getting a little hysterical. I said, no, my husband doesn't beat me. I'm looking at the director. I was saying, tell her that husbands should not beat their wives. And then the woman started talking faster, sharing her story. The director was working hard to keep up with the translation. She said she walked 3 hours to get here. She said she won't make it back home in time to fix dinner. She says it's okay if he beats her and you shouldn't worry. She said she's strong and she had to come to thank you for the lending program. It's allowing her to feed her children with money from her embroidery business. Her children are in school. She says she's stronger because of it. All of a sudden, I didn't think maybe this was such a great grant. I felt the tears well up in my eyes as this Filipino woman and I were just looking at each other. She was trying to take care of me. So she finally reached into her apron pocket and she handed me a gift. It was a pair of blue panties with the letters USA embroidered across the bottom in red letters. The director translated one last time. She says she wants you to have these. She wants to thank you for changing her life. And she said she's sorry the panties are so small, but she's never seen a woman as big as you. That's a true story. Coming out to see me on that day was an act of courage. She knew there would be consequences, but she did it anyway. Neither she nor any woman should have to experience that kind of choice, that violence, but you know, it happens every day around the globe. Women and girls are violated as they try to protect their children and themselves, trying to just go to school, going to work, going to get water. So flying back to the U.S., I was thinking to myself, how can I find more money to make one more grant before I leave around domestic violence? So that's one act of courage. But think about another. Think about if you have been in this country since you were one. This is the only country that you know. It reminds me of a girl named Diana, a young woman that works with one of our grantees, the National Immigration Law Center. She was brought here from Mexico by her parents when she was one. She never thought about being undocumented. That's not how she defined herself. Until she saw her peers getting their driver's license, finding their first jobs, and applying for federal financial aid to attend college. Diana was denied these opportunities despite being accepted into the Berklee College of Music right here in Boston. Then DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, was announced. Diana applied for DACA, so she could work legally, so she would not be deported. Diana and thousands of other young people courageously stepped out of the shadows and registered with the government. They shared personal data and information, believing that this was a pathway to legal status. We're grateful to see that just last week, President Trump and his administration decided to allow the DACA program to continue, at least in the short terms, allowing these young people who are really contributing in so many ways, almost 750,000 of them nationwide, allowing them to remain in the U.S. But still, you know, until there's a permanent solution and the lives of these young people are not determined by a tenuous executive order that can be changed at the stroke of a presidential pen, Diana and the thousands of other dreamers are at risk. So why, as a health funder, should we be concerned about immigration policy? I hope it's because that many of you believe, as we do at Cal Wellness, that health care is a human right for everyone, regardless of immigration status. But closer to home, this past year, another example of courage that Faith mentioned earlier, not life-threatening, but gutsy nevertheless. As health funders, we know that place matters. Sometimes recognizing the impact of place in and in itself can be a courageous act. We were supposed to be in North Carolina today, where we know that there are many of our members doing amazing work in advancing health care. But Faith and her board stood up for the values of inclusiveness, compassion, and equity. They made the tough decision to change the place where we're meeting. I've worked for a membership organization before, and I know the pressure that comes with balancing all of the needs of a diverse membership, especially when they're paying the bills, and trying to keep everyone happy. Well, I am a happy and grateful GIH member. I am happy to be a part of an organization that is able to make such a courageous decision. So courage. Courage is like a muscle. You have to start somewhere. I know you guys are going to laugh when I tell you this, but my latest fitness thing is to try to lift weights. I'm only up to 10 pounds in each arm, and I might never get to, 100 pounds or whatever, but I can tell every day that I am getting stronger. In fact, you know, next week, I'm going to try adding 15 pounds each. Who knows? I'll report back next year when I see you. So it's using the muscle, and that's what we're trying to do at Cal Wellness. We've always, for example, invested in communications and telling the stories of grantees. But when I took this job 3 years ago, I decided to do a listening tour, travel across the state, and every grantee that I met, I asked them, you know, what could we do better? Well, the first thing they said consistently over and over again is don't mess with general operating support. We have a history that most of our grants go out in general operating support. So I started introducing myself. Hi, I'm Judy Belk. I'm not going to mess with general operating support. Second, can you get us the money a little faster? And third is, you know, Cal Wellness is right on the issues, but you're kind of quiet. We don't hear your voice a lot. Now, we don't want you to get ahead of us, but we sure would like you to stand with us. You get to get in rooms that we are not in, and we think you should elevate your voice. So this January, after we were trying to decide what to do, as we found we were in a very different political environment, we launched a campaign, Advance and Defend Wellness, with a public statement from our staff and board that was grounded in our values. Values, by the way, that we are committed to, regardless of who is in the White House. And we focused and elevated several key grant-making areas: access to health care, the needs of immigrants, bolstering the safety net, and addressing the rise of hate-based violence. We invited others to add their voices, and in the last 6 months, with those areas as our focus, we worked with our board to expedite $16 million in grants to our community partners who told us that they were in desperate need for resources. The money, of course, impressive, but what was even more impressive that we turned it around in the fastest period of time that we ever had. And in the next year, we're going to shine a spotlight on another area, race and sex, with a public education campaign focusing on the rising incidence of HIV/AIDS and sexually transmitted infections among women of color, especially Black women. You heard earlier that when I headed up the Levi Strauss Foundation, it was one of the first corporate foundations to speak out against AIDS. And some people think that the work is done. Guys, the work is not done. The face of AIDS has changed. We're in the early stages of developing messaging, but we've developed a provocative statement which will drive the message: good sex ain't good enough. And it's been tested well with, you know, my daughter and others. And she said, yeah, Mom, that's right. Let me tell you, no, don't, no. But we will save lives. It's the second time that I've been involved in using messaging. When I was at Levi Strauss, a different time, but still lives were being lost, I went to the marketing folks at Levi's and said, can't you help me with a public education campaign? And they came up with one that won a lot of awards: condoms, what to wear when you're not wearing Levi's. I'll try anything. And I want you to know, it was so racy at the time that MTV wouldn't even run it. So we ran it in Europe. Our NGO partners did some post follow-up and found there was an increase in purchasing of condoms all around the theaters where the PSA was used. So I would say we'll try it. Okay, next I want to talk about justice, a concern for peace, fairness, and genuine respect. I come to this topic with some biases because my thinking about justice has been informed by the injustices that I've witnessed and experienced personally. Although California has been my home for over 40 years, I'm a Virginia girl. I grew up in Alexandria, just outside of Washington, D.C., long before it was the hip tourist destination it is today. I grew up in the waning era of Jim Crow and was born in a segregated hospital in a colored ward just 10 miles from the White House. When I started school, the Brown decision had been the law of the land for almost 6 years. But the state of Virginia has historically been a tough nut to crack on issues of race and justice. My older sister Vicky and I were bused across town to a separate but unequal school, even though there was a sparkling new, brand new school, Minnie Howard, a couple of blocks from our home. As the bus passed that school every day, I noticed something that those students had. We would stop at a stoplight right near the playground. Their hopscotch and four square lines were permanently etched on the blacktop. At our school, we had to draw them in every day with chalk, and it took up a lot of precious recess time. Well, so in my six-year-old mind, I became obsessed with what I saw as an act of unfairness, and I wanted to go to that school. So I remember asking my mom over and over, why can't I go to Minnie Howard? For a couple of weeks, she just ignored my questions, changing the subject. But finally, because I just wouldn't stop, she said, you can't go there because they don't let colored people in that school. And the very next day on the bus, I noticed for the first time that all the kids on the playground were white, and all the kids on my bus were black. It was my race aha moment, but it still didn't make sense. So I kept asking, so Mama, why don't they let colored kids at that school? And she told me, she's a really determined, strong woman, and she says, they're stupid, that's why. And I still think that's the best definition of racism, don't you think? Stupidity. So finally, the stupidity and injustice got to my mother. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund was looking for a few courageous African-American families to participate in a test decision. And many were afraid to do it. My mother courageously raised her hand to join a legal case. And interesting enough, even though they couldn't use race, the city of Alexandria came up with two other reasons. Their decision was that our IQ was too low and we were mentally deficient. So in spite of the many barriers, we won the case, paving the way for Vicki and me, along with four other black students, to attend Minnie Howard. In other parts of Virginia, black kids like us weren't so lucky. Many school districts simply shut down. I mean, really, can you believe it? They just shut down instead of complying with the Brown decision. That left a generation of African Americans throughout Virginia without access to public education. But we had help. We benefited from a collective effort, not only from my mom, who was only 25 at the time, and other young parents who raised their hands, but we also benefited by some gutsy philanthropy. The lawyers, the court costs, even the tutoring we needed to be successful in the more rigorous classroom were all funded by philanthropy. Philanthropy that came mainly through the leadership and generosity of the Alexandria Jewish community, who basically said, we just won't tolerate it. We needed their help, and they were there. Interesting enough, you're going to laugh at this, it almost didn't happen. The court insisted that we had to have tutoring. White students were willing to come to our homes to tutor. My mother initially said no because we didn't have running water. We didn't have indoor toilets. She's a proud woman and was saying, I'm just not going to let white people come in. What if they go to the bathroom? So, you know, they had strong bladders. They did the tutoring. We got through it. But it still took another decade before the feds really stepped in to really insist that the city of Alexandria, I was almost a senior in high school. And as a result of all of that, I think most of you know, we had Remember the Titans movie was based on the city going through that integration period. It's a great movie. It's about football, but it's also about community coming together. And the real Coach Boone is not as cute as Denzel Washington, so I can just tell you that. So now, fast forward to a couple of decades from my childhood in Alexandria. I'm a parent. I'm living in Oakland. I have two children who have opportunities and privileges that I could never dream of, thanks to fights led by my mother and countless others. I was reminded of that, though, we still have a long way to go. When my son, Ryan, who just turned 30, when he was 12, he wanted to test his independence. And like I was bugging my mother about the school, he was bugging me about wanting to ride the subway, the BART, alone. I finally relented, but each time I gave him a long list of instructions. Call me when you get to the BART station. Call me when you get off. Don't lose your ticket. Don't talk to strangers. Finally, he assured me, Mom, he said, I'm not afraid. I'm really okay. But I think I make other people afraid. And I'm saying, what do you mean by that? He says, I think I make other white women afraid when I sit next to them. Well, when he saw the pain on my face, another feeling like I was kicked in the stomach, he said, Mom, really, it's okay. I figured out a way to handle it. I just take out a book and I start reading it. They seem less nervous that way. Well, remember my aha moment at my new grade school? This was Ryan's aha moment about race, about being the other. I was naive enough to think I could protect him until he was a little older. I mean, I knew I would have to have the conversation at some point, but I thought maybe, not until maybe he's 14 or 15. But already at 12, he had picked up the painful racial cues, having to navigate this minefield of race and prejudice. So now I want to turn and share another story about justice. This is not my story. This is the one where I want to introduce you to one of my favorite voices in California. At the core of it, though, it too is about justice. So as they say in Hollywood, roll the tape.
I met John, my husband, when I was 17, and I became a farmer's wife. I had a big attack. I ended up collapsing, and I ended up being taken to the hospital and cardioconverted. I'd gone into the emergency room a number of times, and they knew something was wrong, and they told me something's wrong. You can't go to a cardiologist if you don't have insurance. I had two small children. There were nights when we had to sit in a parking lot of the ER because I couldn't afford to go in, but I was afraid I'd die. There were, I mean, every day you'd get up wondering if the next year you're going to live. I was driving to a farmer's market and I collapsed behind the wheel. I had nothing left. And I knew if I could just stay alive long enough to get it, I could get a doctor and I could see a cardiologist. The doctor at the time said that he hadn't seen a heart that bad that didn't kill you. And then I had open heart. It was that quickly. Right after I had open heart, I went, oh my God, I haven't had this much oxygen in years. I'd never been able to be that alert. I'm never going to sit in a parking lot and suffer and die. It literally saved my life. Without it, I would have died. I'm grateful every day.
That's pretty powerful. And as you know, there are millions of Kellys who have benefited and, I believe, been given justice in terms of having access to care. That's why Cal Wellness has invested and will continue to invest in the successful rollout of the Affordable Care Act in our state, as long as it's the law of the land. And, if needed, will continue to work to be sure that Kelly and other Californians and other Americans have access to health care. But you know, I'm one who believes that You know, nothing happens by itself. It takes the collective energy of government, community-based organizations, and philanthropy. So I want to give a shout out to many of my healthcare colleagues and funders who have really worked hard on the access front. The California Endowment, the California Healthcare Foundation, Blue Shield, Archstone, the Alliance for Healthcare, and of course the Sierra Health Foundation. And we're just thrilled that you're recognizing Chet Hewitt tomorrow with the Terrence Keenan Leadership Award. But I'm really fortunate to be working in a state with so many committed funders. So finally on to my third theme, self, me, a person's essential being that distinguishes them from others. You know, we don't come to this work as empty vessels. We bring our experiences, our values, and our pain. For me, one of the most painful, horrific experiences for me occurred almost 38 years ago. I mentioned my older sister, Vicky, earlier. Many of my California colleagues know this painful story, but I know many of you don't. I lost Vicky to gun violence 38 years ago. She was 28 years old, a mother of an 8-year-old son, a talented up-and-coming government manager, and my twosie. I was one of six. We were kind of raised in twos. Vicky was my twosie. She went off to work one day and never came home. Just weeks before, she had been the maid of honor at my wedding. Vicky's loss was a traumatic event for my family and for the very close-knit African-American community. But here again, personal philanthropy helped my family and our community in our grief and healing. Within hours after news of Vicky's death spread throughout a shock community, people start sending in dollar bills, checks, bags of coins. They were leaving them on the steps of the church. Ifani was amassing thousands of dollars, a grieving community wanting desperately to ease its own pain by giving back. Those early donations launched the Vicky Belk Scholarship Fund, which now it's in its 35th year and has provided small educational scholarships to hundreds of African-American young people in Alexandria. I'm never going to get Vicky back, but she's still in my thoughts every day as I live and do my work. Years before I took this job as CEO, the work of the California Wellness Foundation caught my eye. It was the first foundation I knew of almost 35 years ago, where the board then and my predecessor, Gary Yates, embraced research that demonstrated that violence, including gun violence, is a public health issue, which means that it can be prevented. Vicky's death could have been prevented. Gun violence has killed 35,000 Californians in the last decade alone. Think about that number. It's like losing the entire population of UCLA or Boston University. So you can imagine, last Monday was a particularly difficult day for me when I woke up to hear that yet again, two shooting incidents were in the news. One targeted members of Congress and happened in my hometown of Alexandria, Virginia, in the quiet Delray community, which I know well, and another at the UPS Center in San Francisco, which claimed 4 lives. After the 2015 mass shooting in San Bernardino, California, we at the foundation heard from many individual donors and foundations who wanted to join in our efforts more, to help more with gun violence. So we seeded a new statewide pool fund called the Hope and Heal Fund. Individuals, foundations, and corporate giving programs can come together in the state of California to invest in preventing domestic violence, community violence, and suicides, which is more victims die from suicides from gun violence than any other. We also want to applaud other funders, such as the Bloomberg and also the Joyce Foundation, which has a national collaborative fund called the Fund for Safer Futures. You know, as I look back over my career, I feel like I've done okay for someone who was initially thought of as mentally deficient. I realize I've been on a search for alignment, finding work that's aligned with who I am, not having to be someone outside of work, someone who can bring it all in one place. I've been fortunate in working for values-driven organizations that given me the space to color outside the lines. In closing, I'd like to end with a few questions for you related to courage, justice, and self. Courage, what big, bold problem are you working on? What are you scared about? I'd say go to that place where you're scared. I've done some of my best work when I've been hyperventilating and have this really queasy feeling in my stomach. Justice, where is the justice in the work that you're doing? Self, are you in the right place to do your work? If not, what are you going to do about it? What can you do to make that place the right place for you to do your work? And finally, don't take anything for granted. I try not to. I'm grateful every day for colleagues at Cal Wellness, the board, the staff, both of whom have made me a better leader. I'm really grateful for being part of this sector. Your work inspires me. It helps me get out of bed every day. We are really privileged to be able to be doing this work at this time, to be of service to our communities, to those individuals who have so much to offer but can't get access to life's most basic needs, and to this country that I love deeply. But I love this country like I love my family. I have high expectations of those who've been given a lot of privilege, opportunities, and resources. And finally, I'm grateful for the little things in life. Running water, bathrooms. Guys, a house can never have too many bathrooms, I'm telling you. And most of all, I'm grateful for you listening. Please come up if I don't know you. Tell me your stories. I'm not great on names, but I'll always remember a story. And I hope the bar is going to be open soon. So thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.